and emotions. So in this, we have the power of the soul, even in its generative polarity. We have then the concept of the soul as the beautiful. And if love is the emotional polarization of beauty on its highest and most complete perfection, so the most odious and terrible of the emotional perversions of the soul is hate. Hate representing merely the complete irrational or intoxication of the emotion of the soul itself. Therefore, hate is associated with the toxin of body, and the Greeks insisted that no being out of a body could hate. It is a thought at least, because it is the combination of the absorption of the psychic energy in the conflict of environment, resulting in loss or gain, adjustment or non-adjustment, the false developments of competition and comparison, and all of these things which make hate possible. So hate is the final ignorance of the emotional polarity of the soul. If then the soul is beauty, and of its own nature is always beautiful, then in its various levels, it bestows itself under normal conditions. Mind may be selfish. Mind may be devoted to innumerable unreasonable opinions, beliefs, and ideas. If the psychic energy is used to vitalize these, then we have just the same situation on the mental level that we have when the soul vitalizes uncontrollable passions on the physical level. It therefore follows that as the soul must build and does build its bodily house, so over great periods of time it must build its internal or intellective house. And this is where we get back again now, having described our problem of beauty, to this little matter of education, which we started on. The Greeks particularly held that there were two complete systems or structures of education. And Comenius, in relation to the establishment of this Pansophic university, which became the basis of our present public school system, emphasized this point also, but not strongly enough for modern educators to have remembered it. He says, for example, that the child goes to school, learns to become a person. The mature individual associates himself with a teacher, a master, a scholar, and devotes the second part of his life to the improvement of this inner part of him. Pythagoras in his school at Crotona, for example, did not teach children. He brought adults together, put them in the first grade, and started them out again. He did it not because he went over the common lessons that they had learned before, but he put them into the first grade of another system, a higher order of learning, which was essential for the cultivation of the superior being within themselves. Thus, as the child learns its letters and its so-called three A's, many of which are not well taught today, by the way, a grown disciple going on into the ways of wisdom entered into what the Greeks and later the Germans called the gymnasium, and there they went on and learned the mature philosophies of adult living. There they began the study of philosophy. There they began to recognize the need for becoming acquainted with the purpose for themselves, and the destiny which they were intended by the universe to attain. For as our education of children adjusts the child to make a living in the world, so the education beginning in the temple and in the mystery school and in the schools of the great teachers adapted the adult to build a life in the universe, to build a full and complete statement of himself. Such a procedure is entirely contrary to our thinking, but based upon that procedure, Greece, in the period of about 300 years, contributed more creative thinkers and great founders of knowledge to the world than probably any other nation in twice the same length of time. There were probably more Greek creative thinkers alive at one time in Athens in the 4th century B.C. than there have been in the entire history of European thought in the last 500 years. Because one list alone of really great outstanding thinkers among the Greeks went to over 300, and each one of these made a basic contribution to human knowledge, whereas today we are simply building upon those foundations and reforming, revising, and amplifying a wee bit. But who today is inventing arithmetic, geometry, biology, or physics? That was done in those good old days, which we look upon as benighted and extremely limited. But in the concept of the disciplines involved, the soul moving gradually towards the positive polarity must overcome step by step the limitations of the untutored mind. Now, as Confucius pointed out, if the soul only had ignorance to contend with, it would be a simple matter. But it has something infinitely worse than ignorance, and that is wrong knowledge. If the individual doesn't know, we can teach him. But if he doesn't know he doesn't know, it is more difficult. And if he is fully convinced that that which he knows is right and it is not right, he is most difficult of all. So to the average person, most true learning is unlearning, getting rid of that which is not so. Now, if an energy is fed into an instrument that is moving and operating like a machine and fuel is given to it, it will continue to run according to the pattern that it has been following. And the soul energy moving into a corrupted intellectual nature, or one immature and insufficient, produces another series of phenomena. And we have all kinds of perverse, destructive intellects, ranging perhaps from the simple, selfish individual to some outstanding example of human arrogance and egoism, like Adolf Hitler or somebody like that. All of these represent energy moving through an inadequate vehicle, moving through and involved in the toxin of the mind. Thus, the purification and regeneration of the intellect is a slow and difficult task, and results in the infinitude of different degrees of mind, which we find everywhere in the world. Because, according to the Greeks, and I think it is true, when all men reach the perfection of their intellect, they will have identical thoughts. Because they will then be capable only of universal thought, which is identical, and can have no diversity or division within it. Therefore, all difference of opinion, while necessary at a given time, must ultimately lead to an absolute identity. And this is another Pythagorean theorem also, namely, that all error differs, all truth is the same. And we agree to the degree that we share either a common knowledge or a common ignorance. though individuals can share a common ignorance and have agreement about that which is not so. But they may ultimately share a common wisdom and have agreement about that which is so. The soul continuing onward in its path and gradually over a period of time, gaining dominion over the intellect as it has previously gained dominion over the body, finally establishes the state of maturity in the mind, even as it establishes the state of maturity in the body. Now, what is the state of maturity in the body? The state of maturity is the power to reproduce, directed and controlled by reason. In other words, maturity of the body means fertility of the body under discipline. And in the Greek thinking, maturity of the intellect was also fertility under discipline. In other words, anything which reaches maturity is capable of bearing life. And the final proof of maturity is to give life, to bear life. Therefore, the intellect, when it reaches maturity, becomes zero in its own level, and therefore is capable of bearing life. When the intellect bears life, we call it creativity. And when the body bears life, we call it generation. The intellect, which is mature, is capable of giving birth to ideas. Now, what does it mean by giving birth to ideas? Does it mean that the intellect actually is able to fashion from that which is not a substance or a nature which is? This comes back to the old question in the first verse of Genesis. What did the gods create the universe out of? The answer, of course, is that creativity is not the creation of something from nothing, but the objectivity of things from no thing. In other words, from potential into potency. Because all ideas, all thought, all concepts, all creations, mental, emotional, or physical, of which man is capable, exist eternally in archetypal nature. Creativity is therefore man's rapport with archetype, by means of which he is able to bring through some design or pattern which exists forever in the tracing of the divine mind. Thus, for example, before the time when man ever invented a locomotive, the concept or the laws governing that invention resided eternally in the divine nature, along with all the other ideas which we have not yet had, and which anyone may discover any moment. And one of the peculiar laws that we discover in the matter of ideas is that they are nearly always simultaneously released by more than one person. And practically every invention that we have had and every step in science has been spontaneously generated in several places almost at the same time. So what we call creativity is the capacity to bring through into manifestation the archetypal patterns of the universal mind. And maturity, therefore, is the power of the intellect to create a mental body for the embodiment of a concept existing in the divine mind. Just as surely as in physical generation, we do not create a being. We merely provide a body for a being. So the mind creates not eternal spirit any more than the generation by body does, but gives embodiment to eternal ideas. And, of course, basically, a human being is an idea. It's just a little different way of approaching the concept of archetype.
This maturity is said to have been attained when the soul achieves to the point of understanding. Thus, understanding is the maturity, the second maturity of the human being. And who attains it is said to be twice born, because he is given, perhaps, knowledge with his first birth, but understanding with his second birth. For knowledge permits him to live here and now. Understanding orients him forever, giving him a participation in an eternal existence. The soul, creating these patterns, then, bestows likewise its principle of beauty upon the mind. And when beauty is opposed or is imposed upon the mind, so that the mind is in all things symmetrical, harmonious, orderly, sequential, and without asymmetries within itself, it is said to be reason. Reason being in the perfect pattern within the state of mind. Because to be reasonable means to be harmonious on a level of mind. And reason in its purest nature is absolutely symmetrical, without distortion within any of its parts. But the word reason is here used platonically, archetypally or ideally, not in our common daily usage of the term. People constantly talk about things being reasonable or unreasonable, but most of the remarks are unreasonable. But by pure reason, we mean that in which there is no defect of judgment. Therefore, there is no dishonesty. And what dishonesty is to the mind, deformity is to the body. So all of these are parallel, and the two processes move practically on the same pattern, but on different levels of manifestation. The soul, which has thus become the instrument of understanding, now finds itself in the most complete and perfect state of which it is capable. For it not only governs the body, but also governs the mind. And having achieved government over both the mind and the body, it brings them together into an absolute harmony. And they become the two horses drawing the chariot of the goddess, because they are then pulling together, which is impossible unless they are held or their reins are held by a third power. So the soul is regarded as then moving or manifesting itself according to its own nature. Now when the soul, having of its own being and nature an absolute symmetry, is thrown symmetrically in the compound of body and mind, so that it is manifesting its own qualities without restriction or limitation, that nature is then said to have achieved the beautiful, because it has then achieved the perfect expression of the force behind it and has become a symbol or a design, an emblem. It, to use a scriptural term, bears perfect witness. And because it bears perfect witness, it reveals the soul in all of its splendor. And there are some very wonderful ancient hymns and songs to the gods and goddesses which describe this magnificent achievement, this wonderful state of complete soul or psychic sufficiency. Having thus proceeded, we observe that the soul passes then through the three essential conditions. First, being of its own nature, without polarization, as pure motion. Secondly, moving downward. Thirdly, moving upward. And finally, according to the Pythagorean doctrine, achieving once again equilibrium. equilibrium, being in this condition or in this concept, a perfect balance of manifestation in which neither the body nor the mind are in a state of tyranny, nor do they tyrannize each other. All of the mental attributes, then, are resulting from the manifestation of soul energy through mind, the bodily attributes through body. These two groups of attributes must likewise be subject to great analysis, for as we know, the sickness of the body will hamper the manifestation of the light within it. So we realize that abnormal state of the mind result in a sickness, and that this sickness means that the energies of the soul are distorted, and in so doing, these energies may become the sources of malignancy in the body and of disease in the mind. Because disease is just as much a motion of energy as health is. Disease is an energy moving against or upon restriction. And wherever there is an obstruction to the motion of physical energy, there is sickness. And wherever there is an obstruction to mental energy, there is a fixation or a complex. And what we might term a boil or a bunion or something of that nature in the body will be correspondingly found as a fixation, a complex, or a center of neurotic pressure in the internal life of the individual. And just as various diseases may seize by using energy for their own growth, and thus ultimately destroy the body, so attitudes, opinions, notions, wrong concepts may become vitalized until they devour, eat up, or expend all of the energy which should be devoted to the normal function and growth of mind. Energy, therefore, both creates and destroys. And in the Egyptian and Greek religion, the soul, therefore, had its positive and negative appearances. It was not only a goddess of beauty and truth, but also a fury, capable, when abused, of bringing a horrible vengeance with it. And this is one of the points that we are least likely to realize today, namely that we cannot abuse energy with impunity. That which we misuse or abuse must ultimately return in the form of an avenging deity, wrecking our happiness and life. The term happiness is also associated with the soul, inasmuch as happiness is actually and essentially a comfortable state of the soul. Now, happiness is, for most persons, a passing mood. Well, we do not have it in any extended period of time, and we are taught to assume that it is best, though, because if we were happy all the time, we would probably do nothing and accomplish very little. We would simply enjoy ourselves from now on. For that reason, a moment of happiness is usually followed by some disquietude of one nature or another. But happiness theoretically, the happiness of philosophy, which is the byproduct of achievement, the happiness of philosophy arises again from lack of tension, from relaxation, order, and adjustment within the psychic life. So when the soul fits comfortably into its mental, emotional, physical pattern, it is said to be at peace. And when the soul is at peace, because it has no discomfort within its own functioning, the individual is said to be at peace. And we have a nice term for it, peace of soul. We're all looking for it. But the only way that the soul can be at peace is when the soul is comfortable. Because it is just as difficult for the soul to be happy when uncomfortable as it is for an individual to be happy when walking around in shoes two sizes too small. And he is uncomfortable, and this discomfort destroys the natural equilibrium of his various parts. If, therefore, in the Greek philosophy we study this, we realize that what we call happiness comes not from the body, but from the soul. And therefore, that unless the soul is content, there is no security in life. And this brings us another term, security. And security likewise represents a quality of soul motion. That individual who, turning within himself, as the Greeks say, finds within that luminous power which is the first generation of being, and finding in that power a sufficient light and a source of eternal good, that individual is secure. And all security means to be able to turn inward and find sufficiency. So wherever there is insecurity, the individual is unable to commune with himself. And where he is unable to commune with himself, he must be insecure. There is no external power which can bestow security. We talk of security in old age, and then comes a depression. We talk about the security of our investments, and then comes a bomb. We talk about all kinds of securities, but we're talking about things that can pass in a few hours. The only security which exists is that in which the individual can live consciously in the company of his own soul. That means that when he turns within himself, he finds light, not darkness. He finds an adequate being and not an emptiness. He finds inspiration, guidance, counsel, and not merely a dark, strange fear. If the soul becomes so darkened by these pressures of body, or so completely immersed in mental or material matter that it is incapable of an independent function, its power may be so reduced that the individual looking in within himself becomes panic-stricken because he looks in and experiences the similitude of death. And the most dangerous and difficult of all psychic problems to work with is the one in which the individual turning within himself finds death, finds darkness, so complete and so inevitable that he will say to himself, I believe I have already died as far as any reality within myself is concerned. But the Greeks also assure us that the soul cannot and does not die, but it sleepeth. And like Jephthah's daughter, it must be raised by the power of purpose, the power of enlightened wisdom. In the Christian mysteries, of course, the Sotar, or the Messiah, Christ, becomes the symbol of universal soul and its redemptive power and its gradual ability to transform all things unto itself. And it is this soul power which, speaking through the words of Paul, says that if it is lifted up, it will raise all other things unto it. Now the soul, having thus a nature and a substance of its own, the Greeks believed was divisible from body, and that when motion and energy had energized all of the conscious powers of man, that the power of the soul was then gradually withdrawn, so that finally pure consciousness took over, and that the soul prepared the being for re-identification with its own inevitable root. Thus the soul was a ladder, or so symbolized. And it was also the mysterious jewel of seven stars, because the ancients considered the solar system the symbol of the soul, with its seven planets. And they placed this in the middle distance between the earth below and the empyrean, or the sphere of the fixed stars above. And the seven churches in Asia, the seven rungs of the ladder of Jacob, all of these are symbols of the soul. The man striving or climbing to security ascends through the levels of his own soul, and by the energies thereof, as we find, of course, in the that divine commander of Hermes. There is one more point we must develop our theme, and that is that we must refer to and mention the numerative power and the relation of the soul to the concept of number, thus getting ourselves right straight back into Pythagoras and explaining certain points. The soul, according to Plato and Pythagoras, is a number because of its own essential nature. It is, by substance and being, an ogdoad, or the power of the number eight. The soul is called the number eight for several reasons, and when we discuss the meaning of numbers a little later, we will go into that phase of it. But the soul has seven powers which are in themselves invisible, and it has an eighth power which is tangible, known by the Greeks as the seminal power, or the power of reproduction. So the soul energizes man in seven ways within himself, and also bestows upon him its eighth power, which is fertility. All of these, then, are the essential numbers of the soul. As an ogdoad, or a magnificent mathematical pattern, the soul is a phase, or is an exposition of the concept contained in the Greek of the numerative soul of being. We've already mentioned the numerative soul. The numerative soul is that which bestows number. And in the Greek philosophy, every phase of the soul's energization is by means of number. And it can bestow, therefore, all numbers within itself, which are the numbers 1 to 8. But it cannot bestow the 9, which is the number of man, nor can it bestow the 10, which is the number of being. Therefore, the soul falls short of the totality of man and of being. Yet, being superior to man, by nature and generation, why does it fall short of man? It falls short of man because the soul exists for a reason. And that reason, having been perfected in man, the soul dies and the man does not. This is one of the formulas in the Greek problem. The verbum, or the word, which was an ancient term for the soul. We are reminded of the lines of an English poet. Never the world of its pain be made whole, till the word made flesh be the word made soul. The word, or the verbum, with its seven powers, creates a certain thing. It does so, it is said, by spreading seed in space. The soul accepts the seed and warms it, and brings it to life. And having perfected it as a parent, has the same relation to offspring as a physical parent. Actually, every child is the parent of the man. Every generation, every form of life, should by nature excel its own parental cause. So, because it is the nurse of bodies and of minds, brings them to maturity in order that they may excel it. So what is the only way in which a self-moving energy can be excelled? And the Greek said that the only reason and the only method by which it can be expelled is because it is potentially moving about an unmoved center, which is being itself. Man is capable of releasing being or being released into being. Therefore, soul is inferior to the perfection of potential man, because man is capable of re-identification with conscious Godhood and beyond and above the power of the soul is the fact that, like the Soka, the mysterious myth of the dying God, the Savior God always dies for the salvation of man, and the soul is the Savior God that dies that man may be saved. Now, the mystery of that is the attitude which the Pythagoreans reduced to a simple fact. That which is eternal is immovable. Therefore, before the restatement or the completion of all things, they must become immovable. And they cannot be immovable unless the soul, which is motion, voluntarily relinquishes its power over them. Thus, that which is to achieve or to attain must transcend the power of the soul. The power of the soul is thought, emotion, and energy. It is love and hate, good and bad, life and death. It is all things, but perhaps of all the great philosophic systems, none greater or more exactly than in the case of Buddhism, points out how all of the polarities of existence must be overcome before that which is mortal can become immortal. For nothing that moves can be eternal. And the mathematical concept of this is that finally all motion must cease. And in the complete cessation of motion, you have the state of eternal reality. Now, this leads us to a very interesting thing. Because in the material world, when a thing stops moving, it is dead. In the invisible world, when a thing stops moving, it is God. So you have your positive and negative polarities. Daemon est Deus inversus. That which is below is evil, above is good. And in this philosophy of these people, the cessation of all motion is only possible in what Buddha called the Mahaparinibbana, the dying out of the three fires. And the three fires are the three powers of the soul. Kill them too soon and you destroy all. Keep them alive too long and you frustrate all. This pattern leads, of course, to the great disciplines of these schools. Namely, the gradual development within man of the impulse to break the pattern of motion. And to break the pattern of motion, he must transcend motion. And to transcend it, he must first climb upon it, build upon it, unfold everything that there is in it, and then cast it aside. Now, in the casting of it aside, he does not damage or injure soul, which being of itself a creation of the divine nature simply returns to it again. But in the transcendence of motion, the individual must annihilate good and evil, life and death, pain and pleasure, increase and decrease. He must achieve a condition of absolute equilibrium, which is the end of motion. Therefore, the soul when it has achieved the fullest expression of its activity, achieves equilibrium, and in so doing, it ceases, because it cannot move when it has reached absolute balance. And when it cannot move, it ceases, because it is motion. So soul exists only through the period of strife. Soul only exists while things must grow, improve, become, enlarge, increase. Just as we say, for example, philosophically or symbolically, the alchemical adage, of course, that ultimately man would possess the elixir of life and live forever. Thus he would outwit the two great polarities, life and death. He would remain forever in the full vigor of his years. Therefore, he would, again, outwit the polarities, youth and age. He would never be sick. Therefore, he would outwit the polarities of health and sickness as polarized factors in his existence. The adept who lived forever was also supposed to live in a perfect world, the golden age to come, in which nothing suffered, nothing sickened, nothing died, in which the streets were paved with something resembling gold, and you could draw all the money you wanted out of the bank without putting any in. There's been a great many concepts of what constituted the golden age. To most people, it's the time when they stop work forever and enjoy themselves and have no wants and live in a glorious socialized paradise in which everyone is equal except themselves and they are superior. That is a concept. But there will be no sorrow there. There will be no parting there, which is almost another way of saying no polarity. Now this condition, which lies in the subconscious symbolic patterning of the human being, is obviously a static state. And we are warned against such states as being most destructive in our thinking and in our conduct, because we must be active, not passive. Yet our total concept of existence is foreverness of peace and happiness. We know, for example, that no one could ever be happy forever in a polarized universe. The individual could not be forever content in a sphere of action and reaction. The achievement of these totalities must come from the suspension of motion, both quantitative and qualitative. He can never attain it while there is an interval between himself and reality, for example. For as long as this interval exists, he is ignorant of something. And as long as he is ignorant of something, he is miserable over something. He can never attain these ends except by the absolute suspension of polarized existence. Motion must cease. Motion ceases in its own source. Wherever motion ceases, in form, we say death sets in, which is disintegration, and we regard it as a most unhappy circumstance, even though disintegration itself is full of motion. But the philosophic death of adeptship, or of the nirvana, is the absolute transcendence of motion. That condition in which being is reaffirmed and all growth of man in nature is toward it. Because ultimately, the only reason why he seeks beauty is because beauty in itself, because of its complete orderliness, is a diminution of motion. Where there is beauty, there is no conflict. Where there is no conflict, there is no exhaustion. So gradually, by eliminating all deficiency and reducing all superabundance, the end of the entire program must always be equilibrium. And equilibrium means that the soul, having brought all parts of the nature into perfect order, that its primary purpose, which was to move toward order, having been fulfilled, no more motion is possible. Because there is no more motion conceivable beyond the ultimate move by which a being is re-identified with being itself. Being is not immovable, but it is with complete suspension of motion. Therefore, it is the unmoved mover of all other things. And that which is unmoved, as Buddha says, in pain or pleasure, that which is itself superior to quality or condition, gradually rises triumphant over the mystery of soul. And in this, psychology is also deficient. For while obviously and beyond any question of doubt, such a state as we describe is an ultimate remote to us and not to be conceived for an incredible period of time, either historically or psychologically, still, all things are either leading in the direction of ultimate or are opposing this direction. Therefore, if re-identification with the suspension of motion is the ultimate state which nature has desired for man, and which therefore is the ultimate good for man, regardless of how he may look at it, then man's growth should be with this recognition or realization somewhere within his own being. And he should recognize the moral value and the ethical significance of integration away from conflict, and that unification, or the bringing together of divided parts, is an essential purpose of his own nature. Motion exists only until this ultimate union has been achieved. And in a state of ultimate union, there is no longer motion. Because things which are one neither separate from each other nor come together. And as motion must involve these processes, quantitatively or qualitatively, motion is transcendent. Now we refine motion and emotion. We say, for example, that we will redeem passion and transform it into a gentler emotion, compassion. What is a gentler emotion? Less motion. More quality of motion and less quantity of motion. And when motion becomes all quality and no quantity, it becomes immovable. Thus, perfection is a complete suspension not only of motion, but of the need for it. For things having been brought into their primordial and archetypal form, in which the distances between center and circumference are equal everywhere, and these distances themselves have been absorbed and annihilated by the dominance of being, then there is neither going nor coming. There is neither approaching nor departing. The great life of man is a motion of approaching reality. Motion ceases when the end is reached. No man runs after he has won the race. And yet no man dare stop until the race is run. The soul, therefore, gives us the power to win the great race of life. It gives us the means and the energies required to transform and transmute all of the elements and substances of our compound nature, refining them, causing us gradually to outgrow their grosser parts, and furthermore, by soul, permeating all of the elements and substances of bodies, thereby hastening also their own growth. For just as surely as man is warmed for the sun and is nourished thereby, each cell in the human body is warmed by the psychic sun in man. The soul is the nourisher of the atoms. It is the vitalizer of all things. The regeneration or release of soul power and the purification of its vibratory patterns therefore bestows growth or evolution upon every cell, atom, and electron of the human body. And in this way, man takes care properly of his own universe. For just as surely as man depends upon an invisible and eternal source for life and strength, looking toward it hopefully and with faith throughout the entire period of his existence, so the population of man, the cells and atoms of his own body, receive their nourishment and nutrition from the compound psychic achievement of himself. He is their son and father. He is their light giver. And as the growth of man proceeds, great waves of evolution take place within him, and whole orders of life are psychically vitalized. And when he has finished with his psychic energy needs, these energies continue and individualize and bring to perfection every seed which we call a cell within the human body. Thus there is a constant motion of growth. And man, through the improvement of himself, becomes a better god over his creation, just as surely as in space great universal processes are unfolding, bringing man to the destiny for which he was ordained. Thus soul becomes the life of the little lives that are within us. And as animals have group souls, so the cells in man have a group soul. And that group soul is man himself. Therefore, we are not only little creatures growing, we are gods over lesser lives. And everything that leads also follows, which was another well-known Pythagorean axiom. So man, following the gods, leads the chain of lives that are dependent upon him. Thus, in this process of the soul's energy, its numerational patterns and archetypes, the soul is impressing its own original design upon all things. When they fulfill that design, they move to the suspension of motion and achieve quietude. And the most ancient symbol, probably, of total being is quietude. And at the end of striving comes peace. And the peace is being itself, the identification of which is the end of man's psychic struggle. Man can assist this task gently, quietly, and without exaggerating his own claims when he begins to realize the importance of order over confusion, begins to recognize the significant task of integrating himself, and recognizing that the establishment of law and order within his own nature means for him the gradual unfoldment of the good and the beautiful, and the achievement of the necessary, which is the end of his own psychic quest. In this way, by this type of thinking, we recognize the world soul, which is the source of all animate things, or things containing the principle of the anima. We recognize that the world is really a vast soul embodied in matter, that this soul is sprouting forth everywhere, that the meadows of flowers which we see are nothing more or less than soul power breaking through the earth, that the very earth itself has its infinite number of crystals and forms and structures which can be studied microscopically, and the wonderful patterns of crystals, these things, are also souls, in also in another way, bursting in the rocks, within the earth itself. And that as these trees and growing things begin to move, an enormous wave of animal life is again soul bursting into motion, into plumage, into color, into wonderful and innumerable sounds and music and harmony. And finally, this bursting forth of soul reaches man. Man discovers fire, builds shelter. Man begins to trace images of his thoughts upon the surface of rock. Gradually, over a vast length of time, this soul which was in nature becomes in man. This soul moves him. Moves him to build better civilizations. Moves him to release power. Moves him to invent and create. Moves him to move on from the simple primitive life of the aboriginal being to the poet, the musician, the composer, the great artist. All these manifestations are soul moving triumphantly on. Now you might think that this tremendous motion of soul would lead on and on and on until, like Kipling, we would be making our paintings with brushes of comet sails. But that is not the way it goes. Because as this great motion goes on and on, into greater and more superior levels of soul energy, this great motion, like Tao, which is a good symbol for it in China, slowly fades out. It fades gradually away when there is no longer anything that is left that is necessary. So on the brink of the conclusion of necessity, the soul, which is a servant of necessity and keeps moving the wheel of necessity, goes to sleep in the fulfillment of all things that have been well done. The soul goes to rest in the great psychic field of nature, and its materials are available for other souls, growing on and on. The soul carries the being across the great interval, but having brought this being to the shore of achievement, it does not result in an infinite achievement. It does not spread achievements from one end of space to the other. Nor will it end in someone who can conquer the whole solar system and rule it from a blazing comet or a sun. This is not the end. Because the end of great soul power is exactly as we find it in the lives of the great teachers. We find Buddha, who achieved a magnificent power of soul understanding, a simple, quiet man who went to sleep beside the Indian road. We find Pythagoras and Plato, all these men becoming less and less demanding of life, less and less concerned over what we call achievement, less and less inclined to blaze their way in history. They simply were content to prepare themselves for the great mystery of going home into quietude. So the blazing comes while the soul is in its middle part, but as it achieves its greater good, it seeks quietude, seeks peace, and gives up phenomenal action, and finally comes totally to rest in the eternal being from which it came. So soul is ever also being liberated from condition. For when all souls have finished their path, then soul itself goes to sleep in the infinite and is one with it again. And this, to a great degree, is expressed in the northern Buddhistic system into the story of the Bodhisattva. For this great being, the enlightened soul, cannot enter the nirvana until all other creatures have attained. And when all other creatures have attained, then the Bodhisattva also enters into the great peace. And the Bodhisattva, as the soul, must continue to labor until all creatures, through the use of its motions and energies, have attained. And when they have all attained, then all motion ceases, and the power of the Bodhisattva is restored to the infinite.